And I said, well, I was reading the doctor's opinion. And he said, well, what book did you get it out of? I said, well, out of this big book. I had one of the little softback versions of the big book that had just come out. He said, show that to me, and I did. And he left. The next day, he walked up to me. Before he got to me, he started crying. I mean, real big tears. He said, Joe, I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober member, for 39 years. And I didn't know that chapter was in the book. Had never read it. Didn't know. But he did say, I'm going to go back home and start me a big book study. And we're going to learn about the doctor's opinion. Most important that we understand what our problem is. Can't solve any problem until we understand what it is. The doctor's opinion explains that.
You know, AA's been around long enough now, since 1935, that today we kind of take a lot of this stuff for granted. Mm-hmm. I don't think we really realize how fortunate we are to have lived in the century when they determined what alcoholism really is. Because based on what it really is, we were able to find a solution. I don't think we really realize the great debt of gratitude that we owe to this little doctor called Dr. Silkworth. Now, prior to 1930, nobody understood alcoholism. Alcoholism is not anything new. We can go back in the oldest recorded history of humankind, and we can always find references to the alcoholic, to the drunkard, to the dipsomaniac, to those who drank too much. One of the oldest sources of information we have happens to be the Bible. And you find several references in the Bible to alcoholism. And one that I always kind of enjoy talking about is a book in the Bible that was written by a fellow named Solomon. And you know, Solomon was a learned individual of his time. Great wisdom.
First social worker the world's ever known.
People had problems. They came to Solomon and they would ask him and he would give them an answer. And apparently one time somebody asked him about the alcoholic. And Solomon said, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has redness of eyes? Those that tarry long at the wine. Everybody was a wino in those days. They didn't have the hard stuff. And he went ahead to describe the alcoholic. He said, you will be as one who lieth down in the midst of the sea. Remember how you used to go to bed at night and that old bed start moving around on you? Or sleepeth at the top of a tall mast, swaying back and forth. He said, you will say they have beaten me, and I felt it not. Remember how you used to get up in the morning, you got bruises all over you, and you don't remember how in the hell you got them? And he assured him through some of his men, and he said, and thine eyes shall behold strange women. And their hearts shall utter perverse things.
You're like, trust me, honey, please trust me.
But then he said the most telling statement of all. He said, they will arise in the morning and seek it yet again. Almost a perfect description of alcoholism as we know it today. But he had no solution for it. Well over 500 years ago, there was a doctor in England named Trotter. And Dr. Trotter said alcoholism is a disease. But he had no solution for it, other than just complete abstinence, no drinking whatsoever. He couldn't explain it. He didn't understand it. Here in our country, over 200 years ago, there was a doctor named Benjamin Rush. And he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And he wrote a paper on alcoholism. And he said that it was a disease also. But he didn't understand it. And he didn't have any solution for it other than just don't drink, period. So alcoholism has been with us forever. And people have always tried to figure out the alcoholic. And all the opinions about the alcoholic. Drake came from non-alcoholics. You know, they're the ones that said we had weak will. They're the ones that said it was moral character. The alcoholic never paid much attention to that. Hell, he just kept on drinking. He didn't worry about what it was very much. And it's only when Dr. Silkworth came along that he was able to begin to show us what alcoholism really is. Silky, even in medical school, was interested in the alcoholic. Silky tried to work with alcoholics all the time. But in those days, we're talking about the early 1900s, the 1920s. Very difficult to make a living, a doctor, working with alcoholics. They didn't like to work with us in those days. They really don't like to work with us today. They say we don't like to work with alcoholics because they never will tell you the truth. That's certainly the truth. They said they never will do what you tell them to do. And that's certainly the truth. But they said the real reason we don't like to work with them is they won't pay their bills. Silky worked for the Knickerbocker Hospital and various other different sources. In the late 1920s, he and some other people were getting ready to put together a hospital specifically for the treatment of alcoholism. And Silky was probably going to get to be the head doctor of the thing, no doubt about that. But then the big stock market crash came along in 1929. And Silky lost all of his money, everything he had invested, and they all went broke. And Silky had to have a job. And there was a guy named Charlie Towns that ran a hospital in New York City called the Towns Hospital. And he offered Silky a job there. I think he was going to be willing to pay him $30 a week and room and board. Silky had worked with many, many alcoholics up to 1930. But from 1930 until 1934, he was working with alcoholics in wholesale lots. And he's the one that began to say there's something different about the alcoholic. There's something happens in that body that doesn't happen to normal people. There's something in the mind regarding alcohol that doesn't happen to normal people. He said, they're not bad people. He said, they're not low character people. They can be people from any walk of life. And when Bill Wilson finally got there in 1933 and Silky explained this to him, and we don't know whether Silky's or Bill Wilson's the first one Dr. Silkworth told this to, or whether Bill's the first one that acted upon it. But when Bill got there in 1933, the doctor sat down with him and explained to him his ideas about alcoholism. And it made so much sense to Bill that he could see that hopeless condition of the mind and of the body. Later on, when he took that same information to Dr. Bob, it made sense to Dr. Bob. They took it to Bill Dodson. It made sense to Bill Dodson. So when they got ready to write the book, they asked Dr. Silkworth, can we use this information that you have given us in this book? And he said, oh, yeah, sure you can. And they said, well, will you write some of it for us? And they said, yeah, I'd be glad to. Under one condition. You cannot use my name. In the 1930s, the idea that alcoholism is an illness, you know, the medical profession, the psychiatric profession, just poo-pooed that right out the window. And he said, if I go on record in writing talking about this, they'll throw me out of the medical profession. Don't use my name, just say the doctor's opinion. In 1956, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, had recognized alcoholism as a full-blown disease. They came out with a second edition of the big book, and Dr. Silkworth said, you can put my name in it now if you want to. The second, third, and fourth edition is Dr. Silkworth. First edition is just doctor's opinion, period, see. And I don't think we really realize the great debt of gratitude that we owe to this doctor. I don't think we really realize how fortunate we are. You know, prior to 1930, very few alcoholics ever recovered from alcoholism. Nearly all of them died from alcoholism. And since 1930, alcoholics have been recovering in wholesale lots, millions and millions and millions, based upon the doctor's opinion. So they put it in the big book right in the beginning for you and I to be able to see what our problem really is. Most alcoholics out there today, they don't know what their problem is. They think it's willpower. They think it's moral character. They think it's sin. Why would they not? That's what everybody's told them up until this time. We alcoholics who are members of AA are the only alcoholics in the world that really know what our problem is, that really understands this problem. And it all came from the doctor's opinion. Let's look at it for just a few minutes.
Let's go to Roman numeral page 24, I believe it is.
And 26.
26 in the fourth edition, 24 in the third edition. So the physician, who at our request gave us his letter, had been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Now, there's no must in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm aware of. Nobody can tell somebody else what they must do or must not do. But there's a lot of must in this book. And there's one of them. We must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind.
This is the first time we can find anywhere in written history that the body is affected as well as the mind. Everything up until this time talked about the mind only. Weak will, moral character, sin, and etc. For the first time, we see that the body is quite as abnormal as the mind. I think he's telling us two things. That we react to alcohol abnormally, not only physically, but also mentally. And we'll talk a little bit about both of those abnormal reactions before we're through tonight. The first one will be the abnormality of the body.
He said it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because that we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. Now, these things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we're sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinions to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account.
Now, if the purpose of a textbook is to transfer information from the mind of one human being or a group of human beings through the written word to the mind of another human being, thereby increasing the knowledge of the user of the book, and I think that's what they're for, then it stands to reason the transference of that information is going to be based upon the understanding of the words that are used in the book. If the writer of the book uses a certain word and has a certain understanding of it, the reader of the book reads that word but has a different understanding of it. And the information that comes through is going to be garbled and incomplete information. There seems to be a few key words in the big book that most of us have had some difficulty with. And I think the first one is this word, allergy. You know, most of us, when we come to AA, we assume we know what an allergy is. I knew that if you ate something or drank something or got around something that you were allergic to, there would be some physical indicator of that, physical manifestation. For instance, if you're allergic to strawberries and you eat them, you break out in a rash. The rash being the physical manifestation. If you're allergic to milk and you drink it, you'll have a bad case of dysentery. The dysentery being the manifestation of that allergy. If you're allergic to certain plants like ragweeds, you get around them, your eyes itch, nose itch, they water, and you begin to sneeze. The itchy, watery eyes, the sneezing, are the manifestations of that allergy. So I knew if you were allergic to something, there would be some indicator there that you could see. I came to AA, and they said, Charlie, you're allergic to alcohol. You'll never be able to safely drink it again. I said, how in the hell can I be allergic to alcohol? I'm drinking a quart a day. How can you possibly drink that much of something you're allergic to? I said, besides that, when I drink alcohol, I don't break out in a rash. When I drink alcohol, I don't break out with a bad case of dysentery. Once in a while I would, but I usually didn't. And I said, when I drink alcohol, my eyes, nose itch, well, they don't cause me to sneeze. I don't understand what you're talking about. You need to explain that to me. And they said, well, you don't need to understand. They said, all you need to know is you just can't drink it. Today I think I know why they told me that. I don't think they understood it a bit better than I understood it. And I would go to person to person to person to person, old-timers in AA, trying to get somebody to explain this allergy thing to me. And the answer always was, well, hell, don't worry about it. Just don't drink and you'll be okay. Forget the damned allergy. Just know you can't drink it and you'll be all right. Now, if you've got a keen intellectual alcoholic mind like I've got, and you get a question like that dangling out here in front of you, sooner or later, if you don't get the answer to it, it's going to drive you out of your mind. And one day I went to a source of information that has never failed me since that time. I went to a Webster's Dictionary, and I looked up the word allergy. I found several definitions for it, the same as you do with any word, depending on how you're using it. But I found the one that I think fits me exactly. It said an allergy is an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance of any kind. An abnormal reaction. So I began to look back through my drinking career to see where I was abnormal when it comes to alcohol. And to my amazement, I found out I didn't know what was normal and what's abnormal. The only thing that I knew about drinking alcohol is the way I drank it. And the way those people drank it who drank with me, and if they didn't drink like I did, we didn't drink together. So in order for me to find out what's normal, so I can see if I'm abnormal, I went to the normal, social, temperate, moderate drinkers. Those who drink alcohol and don't get drunk. Those who drink alcohol and have no problem with it. And I said, would you explain to me how you feel whenever you have a drink or two of alcohol? And the answer usually went like this. They said, well, I can come home from work, tired, tense, wrought up from the day's work. I can have a drink or two before dinner. I get kind of a relaxing feeling from it. I go ahead and have dinner, and then I probably won't drink anymore that night. Well, now, I don't feel that way when I drink alcohol. When I take a drink of alcohol, as it passes my lips begin to tingle immediately. Hits my teeth and they kind of chatter up and down. Strikes my tongue and I can feel it begin to grow and expand and swell. Hits my cheeks and they kind of flutter in and out. I feel it passing through my sinus cavities up into my forehead, and I begin to get a feeling in my forehead which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. Now, I haven't even swallowed the damn stuff yet. I just got it in my mouth. When I swallow it, you know what happens. As it goes down through my esophagus, my chest begins to grow and expand and get bigger and bigger. Hits my stomach and just literally explodes like a bomb. I feel it immediately racing through my arms, and they get longer and longer, and hits my hands and fingers, and they begin to tingle and vibrate. Same time it's racing through my arms, it's racing through my legs. They're getting longer and longer. I'm getting taller and taller, and it hits my feet and toes, and they get a hot, intense, burning, exciting, get up and go somewhere and do something feeling. I don't understand a relaxing feeling whenever you have a drink of alcohol. I continued to question these normal drinkers. And they told me some information that blew my mind. They said, Charlie, when we have a drink or two, we begin to get a slightly tipsy, out of control feeling. And they said, we don't like that feeling. Therefore, one or two drinks is all we want to take. How many times have you tried to get them to drink more than one or two? They said, oh, no, this is making me dizzy. No, I feel it all. I don't want any more of this stuff. I found out today that is the normal reaction to alcohol. You know, for the normal human being, when alcohol goes into the system and goes to the brain, it immediately begins to sedate the brain. It is supposed to give you a slightly tipsy, out-of-control feeling. But when I put that alcohol in my system and it goes to brain, in my brain, I don't get a slightly tipsy, out-of-control feeling. I get a very exciting, in-control feeling. You know, they have a couple of drinks and they want to go to bed. I have a couple of drinks and, by God, I want to go to town. It's an entirely different reaction mentally. They told me something else. They said after we've had a couple of drinks, we begin to experience a feeling of nausea. And they said, we don't like that feeling. Therefore, one or two drinks is all we want to take. How many times have you tried to get them to drink more than that? And they say, oh, no, I'm getting sick. I don't want any more of it. That is the normal reaction to alcohol. Alcohol is a toxic substance, a destroyer of human tissue. And the normal person puts it in the body, and the body begins to experience a feeling of nausea and says, let's puke this stuff up before it hurts us. That's the normal reaction to alcohol. But when I put it in my body, I react entirely different. For me, when it goes into my body, I don't experience a feeling of nausea. I experience an actual physical craving that demands more of the same. Their body says, puke it up. Mine says, put some more in here. And that physical craving is so strong that I can't stop after I have once started, and I end up drunk and sick and in trouble every time. So I react abnormally to alcohol. The only difference between normal and abnormal is what did the majority of the people do. If 9 out of 10 react that way, 1 out of 10 reacts the way I do, then we are considered to be abnormal in our reaction to alcohol. In other words, we are allergic to alcohol. You cannot see our allergy. You can only feel it. And only alcoholics feel it. Non-alcoholics never experience this great exciting in-control feeling. Non-alcoholics never experience this actual physical craving of the body. Therefore, it is senseless for me to try to explain to them how I feel because they don't understand me at all. Nor do I understand the way they feel whenever they drink alcohol. So I'm considered to be allergic to alcohol, not only physically, but also in my mental reaction too, Joe.
I was on my way up here from the American Airlines yesterday morning coming from Dallas. The plane hadn't gotten 3 feet off the ground until they started hustling drinks. And I'm sitting here on the aisle, and a guy right across, right over there, was buying one of those drinks. They're $5 a piece now, currently. Used to be $4. And I swear that bottle was smaller. Yeah, but they're $5 now. And he bought that drink, and we've watched him many times. And he was reading a magazine, got him a little mixer, put a little 7-Up in this glass, took that little bottle, not a drink in one of them, put about half of it in there and put the lid on it. Yeah, he went through a little ceremony. We call it the stirring ceremony. Have a little stick like half that big, and he stirred that up a little bit. And he started reading his magazine again. Like to wore me out. And my thought was, so many times, like, man, why didn't you drink that damn thing? You bought it. And we're riding along there, and he's reading his magazine, he'd take a little sip, and sure enough, it happened as sure as the world. So we got ready to land, the hostess come by, and she said, are you through with that drink? And he said, yeah, I've had all of it I want. It was about half full, or half empty, whichever. And handed it to him, and she threw it away. I don't remember ever throwing a drink away in my life. Well, you see, he wasn't an alcoholic. He don't have the craving to alcohol.
If there's any such thing as alcohol abuse, by God, that's what it is.
That's right there. So now, let's read this little paragraph over again because it makes sense now. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinions to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. It explains to me why I would go down by the bar and have a couple of drinks and intend to go home. But I have a couple of drinks, maybe I'm going to mow the grass. I'm going to have two drinks to go home, mow the grass, that's my plan. I have a couple of drinks and I said, this physical craving beyond my mental control sets up the desire to have another one. Then I have another one. And I said, I've got to go home and mow that grass. And after about four or five drinks, I said, I've got to, the hell with that grass. I'm going to stay here and drink. And the next thing I know, it's midnight or 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock or the next morning or the next day or the next week. And I still haven't gotten home. And I come home, my wife said, where have you been? I don't know. I knew a lot of it, but I wasn't going to tell her where I'd been. You know? But I have no way to explain that. But today I know that once I start to drink, it's virtually impossible for me to stop. On my own willpower, I can't do it. Because of the allergy of the body sets up a craving beyond my mental control. This idea about what he just talked about and Charlie explained, explained many things to me that I couldn't otherwise account for. At least I have an explanation for it today. You see, most people don't have that allergy to alcohol. I used to be in the bar, and a lot of those guys and gals would go home about 6:30 or 7. And I thought they were henpecked or other things. And I said, well, you know, but they didn't want anyone to drink. They went home. I couldn't go home. I mean, I couldn't go home. I just couldn't do it. They could. But I had an allergy to alcohol. They didn't. That's the difference between me and them.
Now, a good textbook never tells you anything but what it doesn't build on it to drive the point home. Let's go over to Roman numeral 26, 3rd edition, 28, 4th edition, first paragraph. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, now this is the doctor talking, Dr. Silkworth, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, the problems pile upon them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. So here he's talking about the manifestation of our allergy is the phenomenon of craving. He used the word phenomenon because he didn't understand it, but he knew that it happened. Now, the word craving, in the first 164 pages of the big book, always deals with the body, never with the mind. I hear people say, well, I came to AA and I craved a drink for 3 years. No, in the context of the big book, that's the wrong use of that word. They needed a drink, they desired a drink, they wanted a drink. But the only way we alcoholics can crave alcohol is to first put it in our body. Then the allergy takes over, the phenomenon of craving develops, and it's an actual physical craving that was they didn't understand it, and it takes over, and then we can't stop drinking. And we end up drunk every time we try. So the manifestation of our allergy is referred to here as the phenomenon of craving. You can't see it. You can only feel it. Now over on Roman numeral 28, 30 in the 4th edition, he's going to drive this idea home one more time about the physical allergy, the phenomenon of craving. And he's going to talk about 5 different kinds of drinkers. Let's look at them very briefly.
He said the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult, and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. He said there are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They're over remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision.
We call that type one.
There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking, and he changes his brand or his environment.
That's type two.
There is a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger.
Type three.
There is a manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and by whom a whole chapter could be written.
Type four. Now, I always thought I was the next type, a type five.
Yeah, then there are types entirely normal in every respect. That sounds like Charlie. In fact, alcohol has upon them. They're often able, intelligent, friendly people.
I used to read that and I'd think, well, how in the hell did he know so much about me anyhow?
You know, there's many different types of alcoholics. There are people in this room tonight who are alcoholics. We're different in many, many ways.
Now he drives this point home. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Now, I think what he said to us is this, that if all we alcoholics in this room tonight should take a drink, God forbid that happen, but if we did, we would not all react just exactly the same. In just a little bit, one of us would be crying in our beer, oh, boo, the world not treating me right. In just a little bit, one of us would be right up here on this dais, hooping and hollering and dancing and cutting up and having a hell of a good time. In just a little bit, look in the far corner, you'll be two of them getting in a fight over there just sure as anything. Look over here in this corner, there'll be a couple over there, one putting the make on the other. We tend to do that also when we drink. We would do many, many different things. But if we're real alcoholic, there's one thing every one of us would do. We would start looking for a second drink. The phenomenon of craving has taken over, and we'll have to have a third drink, and a fourth drink, and a fifth drink, and on and on and on until we're drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. You know, that's what we have in common in AA. That's why we don't want to talk about anything except alcoholism in AA itself. Because that's the one thing that every alcoholic in this room can identify with. We take the one drink, it leads to two, to three, to six, to eight, to ten, until we're completely drunk. And it really doesn't make any difference how long it takes us to get drunk. You know, if I take a drink right now about 9:20, I'll guarantee you by midnight I found a policeman and I'm in jail somewhere. Some of you might have one tonight, two tomorrow night, three the next night. Might take you a week to find your policeman and get in jail. But what difference does it make? The first drink is what sets it off. And invariably we end up drunk. Nor does it make any difference, you know, how old we are. Doesn't make any difference whether we're male or female. Doesn't make any difference what our religious beliefs are. If we're real alcoholic, it's going to happen to every one of us if we take that first drink. That's the thing that we've really got in common. Now, in 1930, this was strictly the doctor's opinion. He couldn't prove it, he could see it. Today, they know a lot more about metabolism than they did back in the 1930s. Today they know if you take anything and put it in your body, a piece of beefsteak, a piece of bread, or whatever it might be, the mind and body will recognize what it is. Certain organs of the body will produce some things they call enzymes, which will attack that piece of beefsteak and begin to break it down and separate it into usable and non-usable items. The amino acids, the vitamins, the proteins, the body will retain. What it can't use, it will dissipate it through the urinary and intestinal tract. Does the same thing with a liquid that it does with a solid. The body will metabolize anything you put in it unless it's a deadly poison that kills you before that happens. There's been some information come out in the last few years that I think we would be remiss if we didn't look at it. because it really does prove the doctor's opinion. It's no longer a phenomenon. Today, we know that it's true. Now, this picture that Joe just put up here on the screen, this is not AA information. AA is not going to get involved. As to why we're allergic, that would probably create some controversy. But this stuff came out a few years ago, and I think we would certainly be remiss if we didn't look at it. In the center picture, you see the 9 people who drink safely, or they are at ease with alcohol. They take a drink, put it in the system. The mind and body recognize what it is. The enzyme production starts. And it attacks the alcohol and breaks it down first to a material known as acetaldehyde. Then after a period of time, it becomes diacetic acid. Then it becomes acetone. In the final stages, it becomes a simple carbohydrate made up of water, sugar, and carbon dioxide. The body can use the water. If there's any excess, it will dissipate it through the urinary and intestinal tract. The sugar is a form of energy, calories. By the way, they are empty calories. None of the amino acids, none of the vitamins, just pure energy. The body will burn it as energy, store the excess as fat to be used at a later date. The carbon dioxide will be dissipated through the lungs. Now, in the normal social temperate moderate drinker, this metabolic rate is approximately 1 ounce per hour. Now, I know it'll vary with different people, but the average is about 1 ounce per hour. And if they don't drink more than that, they can't get drunk, because their body has enough enzyme production to metabolize it, break it up, dissipate it, get rid of it at that rate. Very seldom do you see a social drinker drinking more than 1 ounce per hour. If you do, you better stand way back, because they're probably going to puke on you after a while, as sure as anything. Let's look on the left-hand side of the sheet. This is the one who does not drink safely or is at disease with alcohol. And that's all the word disease means. Something that separates you from the norm, makes you different. We alcoholics put alcohol in our system. But it seems as though the enzymes necessary to fully metabolize it are not there in the same quantities or qualities as they are in the body of the non-alcoholic. It goes through the first stage and becomes acetaldehyde. Goes through the second stage, becomes diacetic acid. Goes into the third stage and becomes acetone. But it seems as though our enzyme production is not sufficient to rapidly break it down from acetone to the simple carbohydrate. It stays in our body for a much longer period of time as acetone. It's been proven today that acetone ingested into the human system produces an actual physical craving that demands more of the same. Before it can break it down to acetone, that physical craving takes over, and that requires a second drink. Now, I've got most of the acetone from the first drink. Now, then I put in the acetone from the second drink. What happens? The acetone level goes up. The craving becomes harder. And that demands a third drink. I got most of the first, nearly all the second. Now that I put that in from the third, the acetone level goes up, the craving becomes harder, and that requires a fourth drink. At midnight, I'm laying out in the parking lot. They've run over me and broken my leg. And they come running up to me and say, "Can we help you?" And I say, "My God, yes, give me another drink." You see, I'm craving it harder at midnight after 20 drinks than I was at 6 in the evening after 2 drinks. That explains to me why I never got enough. I drank alcohol 26 years. I don't ever remember drinking all the alcohol I wanted to drink. I drank a hell of a lot more than I needed to drink. But I never got all that I wanted. Now, that wouldn't be so bad if it never got any worse. But we know not only are we in the grips of an illness, it's a progressive illness. It always gets worse, never better. I think for two reasons. Alcohol is a destroyer of human tissue. The more we drink, the longer we drink, the more human tissue we begin to destroy. It seems as though that alcohol usually attacks the liver and the pancreas faster than it does any other part of the body. Today we know that the liver and the pancreas are the two organs of the body that produce the enzymes necessary to metabolize alcohol. And as they are being destroyed by the alcohol, the enzyme production becomes less and less. The craving becomes harder and harder. The drinking becomes worse and worse. And the resultant troubles become deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. Always getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse due to damage to the body itself. I think another reason is because of the aging factor. You know, as we begin to get older, the body begins to shut down on the production of a lot of things. You know, I wish that were not true, but believe me, it is. I'm experiencing some of that. If I would take a drink today, after X number of years of sobriety, I wouldn't start where I left off. The drinking would be much, much harder. The craving would be much, much, much stronger. The resultant trouble would be much, much, much worse. Always, when I see a guy that's been sober for years and he goes back to drinking, I go to him and I ask him one question. Was it any better this time? And invariably the answer is, God, no, it's 10 times as bad as it used to be. So not only are we in the grips of an illness, it is a progressive illness that always gets worse, never gets better. The doctor's opinion is now pretty well proven medical fact. We've looked at study after study after study, and they all say about the same thing, that it is an abnormal reaction. It does get worse and worse as time goes by, and the only complete relief from it is just don't drink, period. Now, if that was all that was wrong with me, then I wouldn't have any problem, would I? Because all I'd have to do is say, well, I'm just through drinking. If I don't drink, the phenomenon of craving can't develop. If the phenomenon of craving doesn't develop, I can't get drunk. So all I got to do is just not drink. And if that was our only problem, we could all throw a dollar in a hat, get up and go home and never drink again. I've got a friend who is allergic to all things fish. And every time he eats fish, his throat swells up and he almost chokes to death. Now the fact that he's allergic to fish is really beside the point if he didn't eat fish. But from time to time, he got something up here in his head that doesn't work right when it comes to fish. A light bulb doesn't come on, a switch doesn't close, or something up here, because from time to time, his mind tells him it's okay to eat fish. And he'll eat the fish, the allergy takes over, and he ends up in the hospital every time. And I'll bet you it always starts just like this. I haven't had any fish in 90 days. Surely I could eat one piece of fish. It's probably the damn northern pike I've been eating. If I'd eat nothing but good crop ear sea bass, I'd be okay. Or it might even say it's them damn people I've been eating fish with. If I'd just change my crowd. I'm the same identical way when it comes to alcohol. Left on my own resources, my mind always tells me that it's okay to drink. And then I take the drink and then the allergy takes over and then I end up drunk. So it's important that you and I know we're allergic to alcohol. It's important we understand that's why we can't safely drink. But it's also important that we recognize that's not our main problem. Our main problem lies in our mind telling us we can drink, rather than in the body that ensures that we can't drink. Dr. Silkworth knew us quite well. Let's look for just a few moments now at what he has to say about this mental side of our problem. Let's go back to Roman numeral 26, 3rd, 28, 4th, last paragraph at the bottom of the page.
So now we're going to talk about the most dangerous part of the illness. And the most dangerous part of the illness is not when we're drunk. The most dangerous part of the illness is when we're not drinking. You know why that's true? Because we're thinking about drinking. You see, the main problem of the alcoholic center is in the mind. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol.
Now, many alcoholics are highly offended when you say that to them. They say, oh, no, that isn't the reason I drink. They say the reason I drink alcohol is because I love the taste of it. I wouldn't argue with them whether they do or not. I love the taste of cold beer. Always have, all my life, as far back as I can remember. I also love the taste of cold mountain spring water. I never did sit down and drink a case of cold mountain spring water. Alcohol does something for me that cold mountain spring water doesn't do. You know, as a kid growing up, I was on the outside of the crowd looking in. Always wanted to be a part of and knew I could not be. Always knew that whatever I said, whatever I did would be the wrong thing. Other people would laugh and I would be embarrassed. You girls, I couldn't even get close to you. When I got close to one of you, I was absolutely, completely tongue-tied. One night at a high school dance, age 14 years old, somebody gave me a drink of moonshine whiskey. And immediately that great, exciting, in-control feeling came over me. And I was allowed to walk up to a girl and ask her to dance. And she agreed. I danced with her and didn't make a fool of myself. I asked to take her home from the dance. We got in the back seat of a 36 Chevrolet, and I got to do some things I'd been wanting to do for a long, long time. I loved what alcohol did for me way back in the beginning when it was my friend. Men and women drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. Now, if it gave us the slightly tipsy, out-of-control, nauseous feeling, we wouldn't like that effect. But it gives us that great, exciting, in control feeling and allows us to do things we could not do without alcohol.
I had that same kind of problem. I couldn't talk to little girls either. When I was in the seventh grade, I wanted to, they played a little music before the school started at noon, and I wanted to dance with these little girls so bad, and I'd stand up against the wall thinking that I'm going to go ask one of that little girl to dance, the next dance. Never did get there. My cousin brought some rot gut whiskey, we call it, about an hour old, and that Daddy made. And I took a drink that tasted like heck. But pretty soon I walked right over to that girl and I said, would you like to dance? And she said, well, sure. So I didn't know you could dance. And I said, well, I didn't either. And I look back at that and I realize that whenever we have a problem of any kind and we find a solution to that problem, that's recorded up here on the hard drive. You know why? Because the next time we have a problem similar to that, we don't have to go look for another solution. We've already got one. And it's recorded right up there. The effects produced by alcohol. Many, many effects by which we drink. Most of you can identify with that one I was telling you about. Later on, as I drank more and more and more, I began to do things that I wish I hadn't done the night before. And I'd wake up and I have a little guilt, shame, and remorse as a result of things I'd done the night before. And I'd take another drink or two or three, and that would go away, solve that problem too. And in the end of my drinking, after many, many years of progressive illness over a period of a long time, I found myself drinking to the sickest effect of all, which is total oblivion. That was the reason why I drank in the end. In the beginning, it was fun and dancing. In the end, it was for oblivion. There's only one thing wrong with oblivion, though, isn't it? You wake up, and you got to start all over again, you see? And that's where I found myself in the end. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Change the way we think and the way we feel. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after time, differentiate the true from the false. We get to where we don't know the true from the false. To them, their alcohol became abnormal in the beginning for me to be drunk. In the end, it became normal. The abnormal had become normal for me. And I didn't know the true from the false. I remember one morning we woke up, my wife and I, and I had a clear thought, just briefly. And I said to Phyllis, you realize most people don't drink like we do. And you'd have to know my wife. And she, you know what she said to me? She did. She said bullshit. I don't talk that way. I'm just saying what she said. She said, everybody we know drinks just like we do. And that's the truth. Everybody that I knew drank like we did. I didn't know them. The bars that I went to, those people in those bars drank somewhat like I did. Or I didn't go in the bars. That Misty Dawn I was telling you about, a lovely place. Almost smell it now. You go up there and the guy said, bartender said, you got a gun? I said, no, sir. He said, well, here, take this one. You'll need one in there. It's one of those places. You see? And those people in there drank like I did, or I didn't go in there, and they didn't either. You see? So there, and this is what we are when we're not drinking. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Put a few more little words in there full of guilt, shame, and remorse, too, as a result of the things we've been doing. Remember when you were brand new, they say if you don't drink, you're going to feel better? Well, I guarantee you're going to feel better, right? You'll feel resentment better. You're going to feel anger better. You're going to feel a lot of things better. Because we don't have the alcohol to kill the pain. We're running around stark raving sober, you see. And we got to find some way to deal with those emotions or we're going to get drunk again, you see. Because men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I don't suffer well. Sober, I don't suffer well. I'm going to have to find me a solution to that suffering pretty quickly. It used to be drinking. And that's recorded up here too. It's always there. If I'm not careful, I can revert back to being resentful and angry and hateful and all that stuff. And the only solution I would be able to come up with would be take a drink. Because that's recorded on the hard drive. You see, it never goes away. You see, that's called the obsession of the mind. The obsession of the mind is an idea that overpowers all other ideas. It's stronger than any of our willpower.
He says they are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. So look at this picture up here again. We'll go to the right-hand side of it. We'll talk about the mental part of our illness for just a minute, and then we'll be through for the night. I think I'll get down here on the floor where we can, where I can stand back and see it a little better. My little pen works, I hope. Yeah, that's it. We drew a thing here referring to it as the emotional barometer. Now, everybody has emotions. Now, sometimes we're sad. Sometimes we're mad. Sometimes we're happy. Sometimes we're sorry. Sometimes we're worried. All human beings have emotions. All human beings have emotional problems. And when we were kids growing up, for the majority of us, we did feel like we were on the outside of the crowd looking in. We always wanted to be a part of. We knew that whatever we said, whatever we did, would be wrong. And people would laugh at us and would be embarrassed. We had a hell of a time fitting in anywhere we went. And that night at that old high school dance, and that 14-year-old boy there scared to death, and somebody gave me a drink of moonshine whiskey. And immediately all my emotional problems disappeared. The fear, the worry, the not fitting in, all disappeared. And suddenly, I was like all the other kids. I could laugh with them. I could cut up with them. I could dance with that girl. and I could do the things that the other kids were doing. And that particular night, alcohol did for me what I had never been able to do before for myself. And like Joe said, I've got a little recorder up here in my head. And that little recorder recorded what alcohol did for me the night before. Next time I got into a situation where I didn't feel right, where I was afraid, where I was shy, where I was worried, I started looking for a drink of alcohol because my mind remembered the sense of ease and comfort that that alcohol gave me at that dance that time. And I fooled around and I got me another drink and the magic happened again. All the worries and the anxieties disappeared. And I was allowed to function like other people. When you got a problem, you find a solution, you record that solution, and the next time you have that problem, you don't have to go look for a solution because you already know what it is. That's what they call addiction. Not physical, but mental addiction. And my mind at a very early age became mentally addicted to the idea of drinking alcohol because I loved what it did for me. It did for me what I could not do for myself. And it was my friend for a long, long time and allowed me to function in society that I never had been able to function in before. And it did exactly what I wanted it to do. Now, later on, I began to get in trouble because of the alcohol. I began to drink too much. I began to make an ass out of myself. I began to get in trouble at school. I began to get in trouble at home. I began to get in trouble with everybody around me. And instead of it doing the good things for me now, it began to do some bad things for me. And rather than even think about quitting, I desperately began to look for a way to drink without those bad things happening to me. And I used alcohol for several years for those particular reasons. I'm a slow learner. And I began to have enough difficulty with it that I said to myself, Charlie, what you're going to have to do is learn how to control your drinking so you don't get too damn drunk, so you don't get in a car wreck, so you don't get in trouble at home. Any of you guys ever try to control your drinking while drinking? Well, now then, I can see from this side over here, I can see why I never could control my drinking while drinking. Because every time I tried to control my drinking while drinking, I ended up drunk. And in more trouble and more trouble and more trouble and more trouble. And then finally one day, I decided to use the ultimate that all alcoholics have. I said, well, Charlie, apparently you just can't drink anymore. So what you better do is exercise your willpower and just quit drinking. And I took old Will and I stuck him right in there and I said, sick him, Will. We're through with that drinking, period. And I began to run around sober. And as Joe said, I felt better. I felt resentment better, and I felt anger better, and I felt fear better, and I felt embarrassment better, and I felt everything that was bad better. And I was restless, irritable, and discontented. I was filled with guilt, remorse, resentment, self-pity, fear. And as days went by, my emotions would begin to build up and build up and build up and build up. And right there, it triggered the idea of taking a drink. And I said, no, we're not going to take a drink. We've already quit. The willpower stopped me from taking a drink that day. The next day, I got up, and things hadn't changed at all. I was still restless, irritable, discontented, filled with guilt, remorse, resentment, self-pity, fear, and the emotions built up and built up and built up and built up and triggered the idea of taking a drink. And I said, no, sirree, we're not going to drink. By God, we quit that damn drinking. And I didn't drink that day. Next day I got up in the same situation. Nothing changed. The restlessness got worse and worse. The irritability became worse and worse. The discontent became worse and worse. The guilt, remorse, resentment, self-pity, and fear became worse and worse. And I reached a certain point, and I said, Charlie, you know, you've been sober now for about 90 days. Surely you could have one drink of alcohol. And the idea of what one drink was going to do for me, that great sense of ease and comfort, burned through willpower, and I reached over and took a drink. And when I took a drink, I triggered the allergy. I went through a well-known spree, and I emerged more restless, more irritable, more discontented, living down on the bottom, swearing off I'm not going to drink anymore, sticking willpower in there, and fighting that desire day after day after day, and finally one of them burned through, and I took a drink, and I completed that cycle over and over and over and over and over. The drinking getting worse, the trouble getting worse, the problems down on the bottom getting worse, the emotional problems getting worse and worse, until I damn near died from alcoholism. Now just think, if I could find a way to live down here on the bottom where I wouldn't be restless, irritable, and discontented, if I can find a way to live down on the bottom where I wouldn't be filled with shame, fear, guilt, remorse, and etc., then maybe my emotions would not build up to the level that requires me to take a drink in order to change the way I feel. Dr. Silkworth called that a psychic change. And when he said psychic, he went straight to the mind. In other words, if I could have a change in mental attitudes, if I could get rid of some old ideas, old emotions, and old attitudes, replace them with a new set of ideas, emotions, and attitudes, maybe I could find a way to live down here on the bottom where instead of being restless, irritable, and discontented, I may find a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. And if I find a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness and sobriety at the same time, then I don't need to take a drink in order to change the way that I feel. But if I don't change me down here on the bottom with God's help, then sure enough, sooner or later, my mind will always remember that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. And it remembers it to the point that it pushes out the jailhouses, pushes out the hospitals and the divorce courts. And my mind sees nothing wrong with drinking. And I take the drink and trigger the allergy and end up drunk all over again. This is what's called recovery. They can't do anything at all about my body. Can't do anything about the body. Hell, I can't do anything about my head.
Lack of power is your dilemma, Charlie.
Since we can't do anything about the body, then my only hope for recovery lies right over here in the mind. And everybody's going to have to build their own emotional levels. That's why everybody has to work their program. That I've found a way to live where I never go above that level right there. Now, I'm not always happy. I'm not always peaceful and serene. And things aren't always a bed of roses. But for many, many years, my emotions have remained below that level right there that requires that I take a drink. That's what's called recovery. And that's what comes from the program of action. We find a power greater than human power. And then the power solves our emotional problem. And if my emotional problems are solved, then I don't have to drink in order to change the way that I feel. Joe, read that next paragraph, please.
You know, Dr. Jung called it a psychic change, and Dr. Jung told Roland ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which are the guiding force of wisely people are suddenly cast to one side. Bill Wilson calls it a personality change, a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience. Those are all the same things, by the way. They're not different. They're the same. And he says, on the other hand, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change, personality change, spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And, of course, we know the few simple rules are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And practice as a way of life will expel the obsession to drink from the sufferer.
Okay, what we're really looking at now is step one. You know, if I can't drink because of the allergy, I can't drink without getting drunk. If I can't quit drinking because of the obsession, can't find a way to stay sober, then I've become absolutely powerless over alcohol. And if I'm powerless over alcohol and I'm out there drinking my life, then I'm sure going to become unmanageable. And it don't take very long for that to happen. So this is really what step one is based upon, the doctor's opinion in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all we've got for tonight. Thank you all for being here. Hopefully we'll see you in the morning. Now let's get back to the big book study and get started on this thing. We spent a lot of time last night in the doctor's opinion talking about the physical allergy, talking about the obsession of the mind, talking about the fact that those two coupled together makes us absolutely powerless over alcohol. And for most of we alcoholics, that's the first time we ever really had any idea what our problem really is. We all thought it was weak will, thought it was moral character, thought it was sin. Why would we not? That's what everybody had told us. And now then we find through the doctor's opinion in the big book that we are really suffering from an illness, a twofold illness, an illness of the body as well as an illness of the mind. And we could see why we are absolutely powerless over alcohol. Now this morning we're going to look at Bill's story. And Bill's story is going to be a classic example of alcoholism. In Bill's story, we're going to see what Dr. Silkworth was talking about in the doctor's opinion. We're going to be able to see Bill when he first started drinking. He was having a lot of fun and a lot of excitement from it. We're going to see where his drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. We're going to see him progress to the point where he's drinking out of absolute necessity. And then finally, we'll see him drinking for the sickest reason at all, complete oblivion. And we're going to be able to see the progression of his alcoholism as we go through Bill's story. Also, we're going to see in Bill's story how he affected a recovery from alcoholism. And if we're a brand new person in AA, and let's say we've never had any contact with the fellowship at all, the only contact is the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson's story makes a classic 12-step call on us. Remember, before he went to talk to Dr. Bob, Dr. Silkworth told him, explain to him the exact nature of the illness, rather than talk about spirituality to begin with. So Bill went to see Dr. Bob, and he didn't talk about Bob's drinking, he talked about Bill's drinking. He said, let me tell you my story. And as he told Dr. Bob about his own drinking, then Dr. Bob was able to see himself through Bill's story. And from that day on, any time they talked to a newcomer, that's what they always did. They shared their story with the newcomer. When the big book was published, they knew that the first person in Michigan, the first one in California, the first one in Texas, they couldn't go visit them on a one-on-one basis. So they had to put a story in here in order for the newcomer to be able to identify with it. And they placed Bill's story right here after the doctor's opinion for that particular purpose. A lot of people say, well, we can't identify with Bill. Because after all, he was a night school lawyer and we were not. He was a New York City speculator and we were not. Down in our part of the country, some of them say, yeah, and he was a Yankee too and we were not. A lot of the women say we can't identify with him because he's a man and etc. But if we closely look at Bill's story and we look at how he thinks and how he acts, I think everyone in this room this morning that's an alcoholic will be able to identify with Bill Wilson. And as we identify with Bill, see his alcoholism, see him recover, then we can begin to believe that we're enough like him that if he could recover from alcoholism, just maybe we could too. The beginning of belief, the beginning of hope, one alcoholic sharing with another. Joe?
We learned last night that Bill's first real meaningful experience with staying sober was in the town's hospital with the doctor, Silkworth, giving his opinion. And we know that last night's beginning of sobriety for Bill was to learn what his problem was. He also learned later that when he went to see Dr. Bob, that he was to tell Dr. Bob about his own story. That's what he was advised to do. And that's why Bill's story is the first chapter in the book, for us to identify with another alcoholic, for those of us who wouldn't get to New York. So Bill's story is for identification. And I had a lot of trouble with Bill's story trying to identify with Bill, but I just couldn't do it. I saw pictures of Bill. In fact, I have one over here. And he was an old man, I thought. 43 years old when he published the book. I look at him today and he's a relatively young man.
Hell yeah.
He was an old man then, so it was hard for me to. And what would he could tell me is what I figured. But I began to read and study Bill's story and began to realize a lot about Bill. He was a lot like me and like most drunks that I know. He had a great outlook on life, a lot of optimism. He was a very hardworking person, had lots and lots of willpower just like me. And with that ordinary attribute, he became a very successful man, a self-made man. So Bill was a whole lot like me. And I've learned since then that we learned what Bill was like, how he learned he was sick, most importantly, how he affected the recovery. So the whole story of Bill's, of the Alcoholics Anonymous is tied up in Bill's story. So let's read Bill's story and looking for identification, most important. Page 1, Bill's story. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I love the way Bill writes. Anybody ever have any moments sublime with intervals hilarious while drinking? I do. He said, I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot strong warnings and prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier never forgot whether he died by musket or by pot.
Now, for you younger guys, this pot he's referring to is not that wacky weed that we're using today. He's referring to a pot of beer. That's the way they used to serve it in England, and still do in some cases. So he's talking about beer.
I have a bunch of pictures here, which you're welcome to come by and look at. And there's that tombstone we were talking about in Winchester Cathedral. Just so happens the name on it is Thomas Thatcher. Abby Thatcher, Thomas, I don't know. But it's interesting. And there's Bill, young 43-year-old, good-looking Bill. Dr. Bob. Bill and Bob as the time went by. There's the little directory that Bill went to find a drunk to work with in that hotel, Mayflower Hotel. There's the house that Bill and Bob first met in, the gatehouse. That's open to the public, by the way, now.
It's been placed on the National Historical Register, too,
yeah,
by the Cyberning Estate, so it'll stay the same.
Yeah, it cost $3, but they restored that room to pretty much the way it was when Bill and Bob first met there. Here's a picture of Abby Thatcher's grave, the forgotten man in AA. A few years ago, Charlie and I was in Albany. We learned that Abby was buried there in Albany. We thought he was down in Texas. But we went out to the grave to see his grave. And we got out there, the weeds were up over our head. Nobody had been there in a long, long time. Without Abby, there's no AA. He carried the message to Bill. We forgot about him along the way. But that's interesting. Again, Bill and Abby. Dr. Silkworth, our medical benefactor. A picture of his tombstone. Dr. Bob's tombstone. Spiritual experience just being there. Akron City Hospital and Akron Still Operating Hospital. Sister Ignatia. Bill and And Bob and Sister Ignatia worked together for years helping drunks. There's the graveyard of Bill and Bob. I mean, Bill and Lois, excuse me. East Dorset, Vermont. A house where they lived for a number of years. Bill's spiritual advisor, shoemaker. I said last night that Bill Dodson died in 1966. Actually, it was 1954. And there's a statement of his death. This was over Bill's bed in New Bedford, Connecticut. Someone had embroidered that and put it over his bed. But a number of pictures here. Welcome to come by and take a look if you want to. Free. It says, ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22 in a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader. For had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurances. Lots of confidence, wouldn't it? I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world that I was important.
I already identify with Bill Wilson. That's all I ever wanted to do, was succeed at something, prove to the world that I'm important also. It's one of the driving characteristics behind every alcoholic I've ever met. By golly, we're going to show them that we're just as good as they are. The great drive for success was on.
He said, my work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich, but why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or to write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wives. My wives were very disturbed with my drinking. We had long talks when I would steal her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. That the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. Charlie said last night that Bill made his living selling fast talk to slow-thinking people.